The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Christopher Schaberg and Mark Jakic are the guests this week as we discuss their recently published book, Airplane Reading, which was out from Zero in July. Their book brings together a range of essays about air travel and features the work of Lisa K. Adam, Sarah Allison, Jane Armstrong, Thomas Beller, and many other fine writers. The book was born out of a long-term internet project that's been running since 2011 at airplanereading.org. Harriet Paskus, travel writer for USA Today, blurbed the book this way: a marvelous story roundup exploring and explaining what air travel does to us and what it makes us do. Buy it now, but save it to read on your next cross-country flight. It's Thursday, August 4th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. We're still working on our membership site for Zero Books. The site will be rolled out in September to coincide with the new school year and to fit my schedule. It will feature members-only podcasts, online workshop with our authors, and audiobooks. To find out more, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or check out Zero Books' blog at zerobooks.net. This episode includes clips from the movie Fight Club, some Philip Glass music played on a ukulele by the YouTube star Four Blade Knife, the sound of an airplane landing, a Pan Am advertisement from the 60s, and a brief clip from Brian Eno's Music for Airports as performed by Bang on a Can. The music you're listening to right now is the theme song for Airport 77. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Mark Jakic and Christopher Schaberg as we discuss Airplane Reading. Christopher Schaberg worked as a cross-utilized agent for United Airlines at the Montana Airport, the Bozeman on Montana Airport, between 2001 and 2003. He is now a cultural critic and an associate professor of English at Loyola University, New Orleans. He is the author of The Textual Life of Airports, Deconstructing Brad Pitt, both out from Bloomsbury, and The End of Airports, also out from Bloomsbury. He's also the editor, along with Mark Jakic, of this collection, Airplane Reading, which is due out from Zero Books in July. Mark Jakic is a frequent yet fearful flyer. He received his PhD in creative writing from Florida State University. He's a poet and a professor of English at Loyola University, New Orleans. Mark and Christopher, welcome to the Zero Squared podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
First off, what is a cross-utilized agent?
Oh, it's this great umbrella term for workers at small regional airports, and it basically means you do everything. So you get there at 4 a.m. and turn on the lights of the office and go out and get the airplane ready, put fresh water on, and then you go in and check in some passengers, and then you go and take their luggage and load it on the plane, and then you walk upstairs and you board the passengers, and then you go out and you de-ice the plane. You do everything, and the passengers meanwhile think there's some kind of cloning happening because they've seen you in every station. So yeah, my job title was a cross-utilized agent.
Was that a high-paid gig? I mean, you're doing, it seems like, specialist work there, with especially de-icing the plane. Although I guess maybe that's not that complicated. But
no, it's special. I think I went from $7.10 an hour to $7.25 by the time I finished.
And you were a young man then. Not that you're not young now, but how old were you?
This was after college. I was probably 23, 24. Oh. I was just starting graduate school at Montana State University in Bozeman, and I picked up this job to pay the bills while I got my master's.
How many books on airports have you put together now?
I guess I'm now working on either my fourth or fifth, depending on how you count them.
Yeah.
So I'm working on a new book called Airportness, The Nature of Flight, and that'll be out in 2017.
when I was growing up, way back, I had a friend who was obsessed with trains, and he would go out and he would tape record trains as they would go, like on audio tape, just the sound of trains, and then he would read the numbers of each car into the tape recorder, so you could track when he'd seen that train engine and that car before. Have you always been this way about airplanes and airports, or is this something that came to you as of an interest after you worked in an airport? How did you become obsessed?
I think the intellectual obsession took place later when I was in my PhD program at the University of California, Davis. That's when I started really writing about them. And I actually didn't even start thinking about having worked at the airport until I met Mark in 2009. So, I mean, almost 10 years later, it was really just a job to, I had some other crummy job that only made, you know, I think it paid me $6 an hour. And this seemed like, you know, like upward mobility to work at the airport. So I worked there, and then, I mean, I think I've always had a, you know, vague interest in airplanes, but nothing like an obsession. But the obsession really came later when I started reading about, you know, theories of mobility and space and thinking about how airports appear in American literature and culture.
Mark, your interest in airports and airplanes has come through your relationship with Chris and your collaboration with him. You're not as obsessive?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Since I met Chris, I've gotten more obsessed, but I had this lingering obsession even before I met Chris. This fear of flying kind of grew over the years. I didn't really fly in a plane until I was 19, and it was for a spring break trip to Florida and that kind of thing, and it was all kind of novel, you know, and it was kind of great. And then I went to Europe when I was 21, studied abroad in Vienna, and mainly took the train everywhere. But then I started having to do more continental flights because then I lived in Belgium after that. Mm. And I kind of always loved them. And I went to Middle East and went to Israel right after Rabin was shot. And so I flew Hungarian Airlines. I started flying these kind of Turkish Airlines to Istanbul. And I always liked the planes. But then as I got older, and I think after 9/11 probably, I started to get more afraid of flying. Mm-hmm. And that became kind of an obsession with crashes and reading about crashes. And there was one particular flight I was on back in graduate school where I was coming back from Chicago to Indianapolis. I was on a small plane, twin props. And we landed back in Indianapolis, and then we were about to take our, you know, get on a car and drive back to Indiana University where I was studying. But we got off the plane, and right there were the TVs, and suddenly there was news about a crash. A local crash in Roselawn, Indiana. And it was, I thought to myself, wait a second, didn't we pass that? And I realized it was the same flight in the other direction. So that plane crashed and went around the storm, was trying to go around the same storm we went around from Chicago. And I had taken that same flight like 4 days earlier. And for some reason, that proximity to the crash, so to speak, kind of freaked me out. And so after that, I would just, whenever I'd see about a plane crash, I'd try and find out about it, and I'd read more about it, and I'd kind of become obsessed from a different direction than Chris about it. So then when we met in 2009, the first time we met, I picked up Chris from the airport for a job interview at Loyola. And immediately at lunch, we started talking about planes because I saw his dissertation that he had written about planes. And so we started talking about movies and books with planes and plane crashes.
Well, you were finishing your novel at that point that really hinges on a couple airport scenes and plane airplane.
Is this a Meaning for Wife? That
yeah,
novel?
That novel starts out on a plane and ends on a plane. Mm-hmm. Like, so it starts out in flight and ends with the plane taking back off. Huh. And I have a book called Poetry for Planes coming out with Eyewear in the UK next spring. So I guess I've got three books, strangely.
Airplane reading is traditionally thought of as sort of light reading, trivial reading. It's something you just grab. It's a $5 or $3 paperback thriller or horror novel. I read a lot of horror novels when I was younger and was flying. But you want to question that tradition?
Yeah, we want to think about how many different things it can mean. And I think it does mean. I mean, people do choose to kill time in a lot of different ways on planes, some more serious than others. But I think with this book and with our project, we really wanted to push the disposability of airplane reading, push that away and think about airplane reading as something more involving more sustained thought.
Because you have the time for it, I guess.
Yeah,
and it's kind of this sequestered time. You know you have 2 hours, or you know you have 3 hours, and yeah, you can put on the headphones and watch a movie or something. But it is this kind of weird space, almost like like in the old days when you used to go to the library and actually read a book there. You know, where you're in public and yet you're alone. And I like that about a plane too. Like, yeah, you can talk to the stranger next to you, but sometimes I'll just put the headphones on and read and not listen to anything, because I like being somehow at home. I have 2 hours. I'll fritter them away going to the kitchen 10 times and doing something else. But on the plane, I'm kind of stuck. And so it's my own captive audience to dive into something. And I don't want it to be throwaway sometimes, or I want it to somehow animate the experience that I'm actually in.
Welcome aboard. Welcome aboard the spacious cabin, attractively decorated, air-conditioned but draft-free. Newly designed individual overhead light units are an innovation. Roominess extends even to the powder rooms, which look like those in a private home. And a new sensation, complete absence of vibration. Near sonic speed, but inside, one of the most stunning discoveries. There is no feeling of movement at all. No vibration, hardly any sound. A new concept in air.
For me, there are two kinds of really utopian spaces in the modern world. One of them would maybe be a zoo. And I think that's utopian because it's a place where we can witness our separation from the animal kingdom. It's a space that invents itself exactly for this, so we can get a perspective on the natural world and be apart from it. I'd maybe throw in like natural history museums into that same category, or even art museums. We do it in art museums as a gesture where we are separated from our culture and from history. Like, we're somehow outside of that whole process that we're looking at. Airports are utopian because they separate us from locations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you go to the airport and you're no longer in the city that airport's in. You're in some other space altogether. You can visit a city's airport hundreds of times and never visit the city. Like, I've visited O'Hara dozens of times and been to the city twice, Chicago twice. So that feeling of dislocation, of being in a almost fictional space, but one that really has its own materiality and is a real space. That's what I think I like about, or find fascinating about, airports.
These are the questions that my first book, well, my dissertation at UC Davis, and then later my first book, The Textual Life of Airports, really grew out of these interests in the, you know, what Marc Auger called the non-space of airports. And it's interesting you mentioned like art museums, because I've always been interested in how airports use art to almost like redouble that space or that feeling of in-betweenness or, that reflection. And it's interesting that you talk about zoos, because when my first book was out for readers at what was then Continuum, I had a really generous reader report from Randy Malamud, who has a piece in the airplane reading book. And he is the author of a book called Reading Zoos. And he seemed to really get what I was doing with airports. I think having come from written about a similar space, as you say, the zoo, this bracketed space that's invented for this kind of bizarre specific purpose. And airports, you're right, they have that same function of taking you out of place in order to bring you back to an even more important place or take you to a more important place. So I think that's a really fascinating connection.
I want to hear a little bit more about this idea about how airports use art, if I can ask what you mean by them setting up a double reflection or...
Sometimes, you know, especially with more, I don't know, slightly more experimental or conceptual art installations, and the public will react and be like, we don't like this. It makes us uncomfortable. We don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I'm always sort of like, you're in an airport. You already don't know where you are or what you're doing. It's the art is just sort of made that obvious in some ways. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of airports also go for sort of milquetoast art in just sort of, you know, kind of canned art approaches or approaches to art or entertainment especially. But when you get a jarring installation or I at the Sacramento airport a few years ago, they put in this giant, I mean, it's like 30-foot tall red bunny that's jumping over the luggage carousel or something. And, you know, people are like, well, you know, what the hell is this? And it's like, well, it's you know, it's art and you're at an airport. And I think there is something about that redoubling of uncertainty.
Well, there's also in the airports, there's this anonymous authority that's in the zoo as well. And that's in the art museum as well. I mean, in airports, it's really more direct than the other two places because you're like being dicked around. You're being, you know, yeah, go over here, just stand there, uh-huh. You know, act like, you know, get on board now, sit down, shut up. That's going on. Whereas in an art museum, you're free to wander, but you're being directed more subtly. In both spaces, there's this sense of cultural authority or some sort of universal authority that is telling you what is right or what is going on. So I frequently will find in airports art that presents itself as history and maybe has a political message to, like, celebrating diversity, the history of African-American art in New Orleans, say, and they find that in their airport. That's the kind of thing that fits well into airports.
Yeah, and I think for me, you know, working at the Bozeman, Montana airport, traveling through Denver a lot and SeaTac and PDX, I was always interested in how Western airports do something similar with art, sort of presenting history, but really by way of subtly naturalizing a political agenda about what the American frontier is or should mean to us. I always was tuning into that. When were these Western aesthetics being deployed at the airport to make us feel kind of vaguely patriotic or like we're on some grand journey? Yeah. When we're really just being dicked around, as you say.
So, Mark, it seems to me like you have a very different perspective on this. For you, it's not about the space, the airport. It's about the act of flying, this miracle of flight and how frightening it is. Do you think these two things are connected? And how did the airplane or the airport fit into your novel?
I think it had to do with flight. You know, it's not really a fear of flying. It's a fear of, like, dying, of course, right? That's right. The flight is very sublime when you're above the clouds and all that. It's the most sublime place I can think of. You stand over a cliff, that kind of thing. But, you know, it's terror-filling and also sublime at the same time. But so it's the fear of, like, those last moments or whatever. And then this is just putting a point on it. But I guess the novel starts in the seats in a plane. You know, like, kind of claustrophobia, and you know you can't escape. You're not in control, right? And it's actually with a child. It's with the main character's 1.5 year old. So there's that kind of pressure, two children on a plane idea. And then it ends, that plane's going to land in the beginning. And then the end of the novel is the plane's going to take off, and it's still the same setup. It's still like the dad and then this 1.5 year old. But all these things have transpired in the little weekend trip, the 3-day trip. Lots has happened to the narrator, the main character. And so that flight is on the way there, so it's claustrophobic and limiting. On the way out, it's liberating, you know, literally taking off. And it's like a, you know, it's breaking some kind of new territory.
The connection between death and flight and airports, I think, is worth talking about a little bit, and connecting it back to zoos. The thing about zoos is the reason they're utopian is they give you the sense that you're taking a view of the natural world from a space where you're not a part of it, meaning, you know, the chimpanzee is this flesh and blood thing, but you're over here behind the glass as an observer that's almost dematerialized in some
sure
way. At airports, while you're in the airport, you are, it's a different, you're the monkey. You know, you're the one behind glass, it feels like, yeah, to me. And you're the meat that has to be shipped around. So while you're in the air, maybe, and maybe enjoying a beverage, maybe there's a moment of feeling like you're actually literally above it all and literally somehow transcending your mere fleshiness. But up until that point, it's just fraught with danger. And
right.
So go ahead.
No, but you put your finger, I mean, I get that friction between, you know, literally being up in the air and looking down on things, right? So that seems kind of like a powerful position, of course, or right? Everything's so small down there. You can't believe you fly over the Bay Area, like, oh, it's just all those .com people doing their thing. But like, you know, it's just a little speck when you start to get high. So there's that. But on the other hand, you know, once I started to look at the science of flight, the Bernoulli effect and stuff, that's supposed to kind of calm you to understand how a plane, I remember a pilot once saying, the plane is more comfortable in the air than on the ground. Like, its natural place is to be in the air.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Right? But of course, to me, who's a little, you know, afraid of, like, I think this thing weighs 3 million, whatever, 1 million pounds. It's not natural to be in the air, but I got the science behind it. But so when I'm in the plane and I'm having that experience, the sublime experience, let's say, even, I still am conscious of the fact that right outside of that barrier you just talked about, that glass, it's minus 50 degrees. And, you know, if you're at 35,000 feet, what they call the time of useful consciousness, which is this great term I love, right? Time of useful consciousness, that if the plane loses pressure at, let's say, 35,000 feet, you have about 20 to 30 seconds of air before you pass out, right? Because there's not enough oxygen and stuff.
Right.
So that's why the plane, you know, if it does lose pressure, the pilots have got to get that thing down, right? Down to like 10,000 feet where you can kind of breathe, right? Where there's enough oxygen. Otherwise, even at 20,000 feet, you've only got 3 minutes, let's say. That's your time of useful consciousness. And it just, that kind of mindfulness, to be so mindful of and hyper aware of you know, yes, over everything, but like how close you are to death or some kind of oblivion is what kind of gets my mind going, and the panic attacks can kind of stem.
Right.
You ever heard that haunting story of that Greek 737 a couple of years ago that was somehow they lost air up,
lost pressure,
at 35,000 feet, and everyone, but that plane was still flying on, you know, on autopilot for a couple hours, and finally crashed into the mountains or something.
Right, and all the people froze to death on
right.
the inside.
And they're just in there. And,
right. Yeah. Oh,
Jesus.
Lovely thought. Huh?
Have you seen in Russia there was a cargo plane that got caught, captured on someone's dash cam.
Yep.
Yeah.
747 was full of like tanks or trucks or something.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a bunch of pilots from Michigan, and they were like buddies, and they'd been flying these cargo routes for, you know, some private cargo. Yeah, that was a crazy story. And I can't watch that again, but I think of it from time to time, that dash camera footage of that plane.
Well, you see it and you just think, oh, that's CGI. That's just
right.
You know, that's ridiculous. It's just, they just crash. They just the what happened, I guess, was the tanks or the I think it was tanks shifted in
right.
the belly of the plane. So what should have been flight should have been achievable, but because of the shift, now it was just a nosedive. And
right. Yeah.
So yeah. Okay. So now flight creeps me out too.
Good. Well, the precariousness of all is what it's. You know, everything. It's so precious, right? Your life is so precious, and that it's kind of 40,000 flights or 87,000 flights every day, night, since no problems for years on end. And suddenly, there's one little thing. You know, circumstances line up. I mean, I'm thinking about the Concorde that blew apart on takeoff some years ago. It blew apart because there was a flight right before it. I think it was a Continental flight that lost a little piece of metal that was 5 centimeters long. And it happened to fall off the plane and then come directly where the tires of the Concorde, you know, were. And it hit that and it punctured one of the tires of the Concorde. And that's what lit the, you know, the fuselage. And then it blew up. I mean, I think it had 40,000 flights over the Atlantic without a single mishap. And that was the end of the Concorde. It was kind of going anyway, but that was the end. A 5 centimeter piece of metal.
Let's go here. You know, there's blood pumping through your veins, and the tiniest little bit of a cholesterol could clog a vein in your brain, and then the cascading effect. I mean, there's just no end to this kind of thinking.
Right. No, it's true. And for some reason, flight for me, you know, when I got into these, he and I just flew to Los Angeles, which was great, a couple weeks ago. It's the first time we were on a plane together, and it kind of that and the Xanax must have like done it for me, but. I guess the flight, at a certain point, this is a daily thing. Like you have a heart attack, aneurysm, but for some reason, the nexus of the plane and that, yeah, the shepherding in there and the corralling, and then to be on this thing, this object that I have no control over, and then you're in this unnatural state that most of, you know, human history, there's absolutely no clue, always wanted to do it, now we're there, and it's so banal, too, to be on the plane.
Yeah.
All of that put such a point, I guess, on exactly what you just said.
Of course, it was funny. Like Mark said, this is the first time we ever flew together. Mark's sitting next to me. I'm kind of worried about him jabbering happily to the guy next to him. Meanwhile, the guy sitting on my other side is a nervous wreck, and he's gripped, white-knuckling the armrests, and he's shaking, and every time the plane rumbles, what's going on? And he's completely losing it. And I'm thinking, well, this didn't work out the way I thought it would. So,
plus, it was two of the most smoothest flights I've ever been on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
There wasn't even turbulence. And this guy was freaking out.
Yeah, yeah.
He must not have flown much.
No, I don't. Mark said later that he must have had something really important to get to, because he did not seem like he wanted to fly.
Every time the plane banked too sharply on takeoff or landing, I prayed for a crash or a mid-air collision. Anything. Life insurance pays off triple if you die on a business trip.
How did this book come together?
So a couple of years after we met, Mark and I decided to build this website called Airplane Reading, and we thought of it as kind of an online, you know, literary journal, but much more open. And we just thought, hey, we'll just try to gather people's stories of flight, just like we've been doing right now. It's like you start talking about this, and you know, most people have some story or some anecdote or something that's been nagging at them or something they saw or read about. And so we just opened up a call for this site, and you know, within months we had hundreds of submissions and great, really great pieces. We just asked for 1,000 word nonfiction narratives about flight, and we just the site just kept going, and it was a fun project experiment. And then a few years later, we thought let's make a book out of some of our favorites, and we'll collect some more that haven't even appeared on the site, and. We just thought it'd be fun to take the online project and turn it into a book that then people could actually read, even on airplanes.
That's the end goal, really, is to get somebody on an airplane to be reading about someone's fear of. If you can't get the movie Airport shown in the airplane, then you can get your book into someone's hands.
It's funny. Mark gave the book to his seatmate as we were flying to Los Angeles, and we sort of spied on the seatmate reading it and chuckling and guffawing, and it was nice to see it in action, as it were.
Right.
Yeah, I think the thing about the site Airplane Reading, the book, is that we'd heard this term for years, Airplane Reading. What is that? That's a throwaway thriller novel or a People magazine or something. We're like, well, isn't there more? Like, doesn't someone like to read whatever, Heidegger or, you know, Wittgenstein, or like it's a good novel, not just a throwaway one. So we had that notion, but we also thought, and this comes out of kind of my fear of flying, maybe the way to kind of defeat my fear was to really animate it. So by reading about what's happening as you're doing it, like you said, the airport movies. So That's the one thing on a plane, even more than the Xanax and stuff, is if I'm reading, it can kind of calm me down. And so we thought, well, let's do that kind of double duty thing, not just reading, but reading about what you're doing and from all kinds of perspectives. So there's in the collection, there's 54 essays in there. Some are about, you know, fear of flying, some are with children on the plane, some are hilarious stories about a plastic surgeon someone meets. The great thing about the collection is, too, it's not all writers. There's a lot of people who just were regular travelers and sent in a story, or we solicited a story from. Some are pilots, flight attendants, but it's really a, dare I say, democratic book that way.
We really were just looking for all sorts of different perspectives. I mean, the only bar, I guess, was you had to be well written, and sometimes we would do some editing of these pieces, but it was just really, it was heartening to see so many people wanting to contribute their stories. And then we just had so many great ones that putting the book together was easy and fun.
Do each of you have your own favorite story? Maybe you can either one that's in the book or one that didn't get in to the book for whatever reason.
We just heard one the other day. It's not in the book because she didn't know about it. But this author, Lydia Pine, told us about at lunch the other day, told us about how she was in Iran and she was flying, I guess, out of Tehran to go somewhere. And some of her Iranian friends are like, I'm not going to fly on this plane. And she's like, well, we got to get there. What do you mean? Like, okay. So she gets on the plane, it takes off and it's, you know, starting to ascend. And suddenly it kind of dips down a couple hundred feet and everyone's like, whoa. And it starts to try and ascend again. It dips down. People are like, you know, all turning green and things. And she's not a fearful flyer. And she's like, my God. And the plane, at first I thought she was going to say something about the weather, like weather conditions out of Tehran. I've never been to Iran, you know. But apparently the plane was having all kinds of problems because of the sanctions against Iran for years. They haven't replaced any of the parts. These are 50-year-old planes, but with like 50-year-old parts on them too. They can't get new parts for it. So they, I don't know what they do, band-aid these things, duct tape them. And so no one wants to fly in these planes. But I guess eventually that one made cruising altitude. But
yeah,
but it was interesting for me to think about, okay, it's about the flight, but it's also about – suddenly it's a political question then about sanctions. It's a global thing. It's about human rights and things like that.
What's the safety rate in Iran for flights? Is it pretty bad because of this?
Yeah, or? Pretty bad.
We're gonna have her do some research. She's gonna contribute a piece to the site, and maybe we'll put it in volume two of this book.
What about you, Chris? Do you have a favorite story or one that you want to share?
I can open up the book to pretty much anyone and immediately get into it and feel like it's my favorite. Really, everyone just shows it a different facet of this prismatic experience of flight. I really like the diversity of approaches. Let me think of a couple that I like. We have two that I'll just mention here. Pam Houston's is called Why I Love to Fly. And she just writes this very, fun, upbeat piece about flying home to her ranch in Colorado and all the mundane details of frequent flight that she nevertheless loves because these flights take her home. And then right next to that one, I think we have Ian Bogost's piece called Frequent Flight. And it's just sort of about the grind of frequent flight. And it's not exactly saying he hates flight, but it's not, you know, the charm has been long lost. And I like the juxtaposition of those two. And we have several in the book that are juxtapositions that it's like two, you know, not quite opposite, but very different views of the same or similar experiences.
I'll tell you one thing that I thought of while you were describing loving to fly and getting somewhere, you know, getting home again. The opposite side of that is getting somewhere very far away from where you normally, you know, from where you normally live. And the feeling of dislocation that flight can bring. And I, several years ago now, went to Paris. And it was very odd to me to be in Paris for the first day because I had been in Portland, Oregon, 7 hours earlier. I mean, it's that simple. I was now in even the Paris airport was different from an airport in the United States. I was definitely somewhere else. And I felt like maybe I'd been transported in Star Trek style or something. Right. Just was not enough time. Not enough time had gone by for me to get from where I had been, West Coast of the United States, to Paris. And I felt dislocated. And I think that's what jet lag is about, too, is that.
It made me think of a piece that's not in the book, but it's on the website by Tim Lance, who's my old student. But he lived in China for many years. And he came back. He wanted to surprise his brother. His brother lives in Michigan. And so he flew back from China for his birthday, for his brother's birthday. And so he left on one day and he arrived the same day, you know, and that's talk about flights. I don't know how many flights did it take. And he shows up and it was still the same day, you know, it's
right.
And it was kind of a heightened experience, what you're talking about. And from China to Michigan,
the power of flight brings completely disparate worlds together. It creates its own third world that not like the third world, but a third space that connects mm-hmm. all these different locations.
Couple pieces in the book too that I think really reflect on that that experience of being just totally out of place, but still with airplanes and airports, there's all the weird familiarity too. You know, like you know how to navigate the airport even if you're in a place where you don't speak the language. You really have no idea where you are, but the airport has this kind of common language, I guess.
Wherever you're going to buy a sandwich, it's going to be way too expensive, for instance.
And not very good.
And not very good. So.
Unless it's Charles de Gaulle, then at least you get like a decent baguette and salami.